handle the truth.
The Denise Simon Experience. The Truth Matrix. Vetting, exposing, drilling down to the truth.
Rolling Thunder, this is Hitman, see you at over. Hitman, this is Rolling Thunder, see you at out.
The Denise Simon Experience. Exposing politics, lies, demagoguery, spin, fraud.
Grid to suppress, Mike Charlie, 435-921. Grid to mark, Mike Charlie, 473-989er, out.
Promoting individual situational awareness. Question, probe, notice, ask why.
Mark smoke on the deck, two rounds HEBT, gas TOT 53.
And now, the Denise Simon Experience.
Hey there, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Denise Simon Experience and WDDQ Talk 92.1. I've got the great pleasure of having Lee Habib with us again. He is the creator and host of Our American Stories. It was actually co-founded by Laura Ingraham's national radio show in 2001. But he has moved on to Salem Media Group in 2008 as vice president of content. And he occasionally writes for Newsweek, and we're going to talk about something happy, which sometimes we can't, it's hard to find something happy to talk about. But Lee, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You know, trying to find a happy story or a good story or a inspiring story, it gets harder and harder, does it not?
You know, look, one of the things that I want to just, hopefully disabuse my conservative friends and even my liberal friends about all of this is America's seen much worse, much, much worse. We've been at tougher times. We've been at odds with each other. But there's so much good around us, and it's everywhere. And we just don't, the media, it gets rewarded for the bad.
And it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, if it bleeds, it leads. And now if it bleeds in your algorithm, it leads. And then we never feel like we're more separated. And by the way, we are. But, we were separated in the Civil War. We were separated during the Great Depression. We were all just
devastated.
Vietnam, Revolutionary War. So 2008, after the great readjustment when it comes to finance and the crash. So we face tough times, and we've always faced divisions. I mean, heck, we've done stories in Our American Stories about the divisions of our founders and how wickedly divided Americans were between staying loyal to the crown and not. And then worse, fighting the British, because a lot of people said, well, I really don't love the British, but I don't want to fight them. And this became a such a devastating time for the Patriots. Guys like Ben Franklin. Ben Franklin threw his own son in jail for 2 years and never spoke to him again. His own son was the royal governor of New Jersey, and the royal governor of New Jersey worked for the crown. And Ben Franklin said, look, son, you're going to have to leave your loyalty to the British behind. I'm putting my name on this divorce paper with the British, and they're not going to take kindly to it. They're going to want my head. This is treason, right? And then the son said to the father, but Dad, I can't protect you. Please don't sign the Declaration. And of course, the dad does and throws his son in prison for 2 years, the worst prison in America, by the way. And then his son goes off to London, never to speak to his father again. His father essentially disowns him. So, I mean, these philosophical differences about these big decisions, they've always split Americans. Any democracy, any constitutional republic is going to face these things. But all around us every day, if we're not loving our kids, if we're not, seeing the good in life around us, the flowers blooming, the sun's shining. Mm-hmm. I mean, oh my goodness, we're living in bounty, and there's real problems and we got to address them, but there's also real beauty all around us. And that's one of the things we try and do with the show is we give a context to life, and particularly for people of faith. Oh my goodness, we're supposed to be overjoyed. And I think the Bible had some pretty tough stories over time.
True.
That are slightly tougher and worse than ours.
True enough. Well, you know, there used to be a channel that I watched a lot, Our American Heroes. And,
Yep.
you know, I love that show. I don't know what happened to it. Maybe it's because I changed internet providers or something. I don't know. But yeah, I think you're right. But you have to, in some cases, you have to go looking for feel good stories or happy stories. And I think that we should work harder at doing that. So that's why we have you, Mr. Lee. Thank you. The one that we're actually going to talk about today is I'll Always Love You. And a lot of people don't know that that is a Dolly Parton song, correct?
Correct. Well, and the story of how that song came to be, because most people listening to her version or Whitney Houston's version or any of the many, many people who covered the song, is most people think it's a romantic love song. And in fact, it wasn't. It was born out of a failed business, not a failed business partnership, but a business partnership that had to end.
That faded
Dolly
away,
Parton
yeah.
was, yeah, and ultimately, Dolly Parton, she grows up. I think people know her story. She grew up dirt poor in the mountains of Tennessee in a place called Locust Ridge. And Whitney Houston, here's what's interesting about this story, about this song. Whitney Houston grew up in Newark, New Jersey, New Jersey's biggest city, mostly black, the child of music royalty. Her mother, Sissy, was a Grammy Award-winning gospel artist, and her first cousin was Dionne Warwick, who was a huge star. So white girl poor, black girl legendary family, and they come together through this song. And along the way, as this song comes to be, and this is the story of how the song came to be, and ultimately how we got to know the song, it would include Elvis Presley and his manager, Colonel Tom Parker, actor Kevin Costner, even Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein works himself into this remarkable story. But it all starts with Dolly and Porter Wagoner. Dolly's young, she comes to Nashville. Porter's got this big hit show, a variety show, and he hires young Dolly to a long-term contract. And the two are just a sensation. And it's not a romantic relationship, it's a professional one. And they sing together, they have some hits together. Then finally, Dolly's like, I just want to leave now. It's my time. I want to be creatively independent. I want to be financially independent. And so she goes, as she said, around and around with Porter, and Porter feels like she's abandoning him and she's betraying him. And she just doesn't know what to do. He's not listening to reason, Dolly said, about why I want to go. So she said, I went home and I thought, what do I do best? I write songs. And she said, so I wrote this song out of a very emotional place. And Porter Wagoner, to his credit, heard it, really heard it, said, that's the best thing you've ever wrote. You can leave me, but can I produce that record? And he, by the way, he did produce that record, right? And it became number one on the country charts on the same day. Dolly Parton also wrote Jolene, one of her other biggest hits. And so, that's enough for the story right there. But no, it gets better. Elvis Presley's manager, the famed Colonel Tom Parker, calls her not long after and says, hey, Elvis wants to record the song. Now, in 1974, if the king of rock and roll says he wants to record your song, you're a songwriter, you're just jumping for joy. Well, Dolly did. And she goes down to Memphis. They get ready for the recording session. She can't believe Elvis himself is going to record the song. The night before, as they're doing the charts in the studio, Elvis is there. The manager, Colonel Tom Parker, pulls a fast one on Dolly. He says, hey, look, Dolly, you're going to have to give away half your publishing. You're going to have to give away half your ownership of the song. And if you want Elvis to sing it. And this broke her heart. She said, I cried all night, but I had to keep that pot copyright in my pocket. You have to take care of your business. So this proved that Dolly was not just a great writer. She was not just a great performer and
Pretty
singer.
savvy.
She was savvy and shrewd. And so again, that's still a pretty good story. But what do you know? Like 18 years later, she gets a call from Kevin Costner. He's producing The Bodyguard, 1992 film in which he co-starred with Whitney Houston. And he said, hey, I don't know if you've ever done, if you've ever, heard that I'm in this business called acting and producing, but I love the song and we'd love to use it on the soundtrack. And Dolly, of course, is overwhelmed. She's overjoyed. She doesn't hear out. She doesn't hear from Costner, anybody. One day she's driving around in Los Angeles And she hears the Whitney Houston version the way we all did, driving around in her car. And this is what she said. She said, I was just driving along and I had the radio on. When I heard it, I freaked out. I had to pull over to the side of the road because honestly, I thought I was going to wreck my car. It was the most overwhelming feeling. Now that song stayed number one for 14 weeks, the record, the all-time record at the time. And it sold 20 million copies. And then this is what Parton said about her decision to keep her publishing rights. I made enough money to buy Graceland. So she became very wealthy from the song. And Houston became wealthy from the song, too. Mm-hmm. And the joy of this is that Whitney and Dolly had not met each other, played together. But through the miracle of free enterprise and the miracle of artistic creativity, these two partnered and made themselves wealthier and made the world a better place.
Yes.
And this song cut across racial, class, culture, geography, and time, and brought the country a little closer together. And no one accused Whitney of culturally appropriating a white country artist's song. That's the beautiful part.
And, you know, if you watch some of those programs, America's Got Talent, or, you know, any of those wannabe artists, up-and-coming artists, singing artists, they often shy away from that song, I'll Always Love You, because it's not an easy song. It takes a very talented singer to sing that song. And there are a few since Dolly and since Whitney that can sing it, but that tells you that there is an exceptional talent. And even today, Lee, that song is still very popular, correct?
No, very popular. It still makes a lot of money for Dolly and for Whitney's estate. And by the way, you're right about that. Many artists would go on to cover the song. The two best that come to mind are Linda Ronstadt and Leanne Rimes. But one Middle Eastern dictator loved the song so much, he commissioned a Syrian pop star to cover it in Arabic, and he used it as his official campaign song in 2002. That's where Saddam Hussein comes in. By the way, he won the Iraqi, quote, election in typical dictatorial style with 100% of the votes. See, they really did love him. Yeah, sure. By the way, he didn't live to see the end of his 7-year term. So there's good news there. He won a 7-year term. By the way, I don't know which is the best, Dolly's or Whitney's. I love them both. They're so very different.
Yes.
But one thing is certain. The song and the cover changed the life of the writer and the singer forever. And it made the world a more beautiful place. And that's what I mean about the beauty. You know, that these things, this is as close as we get to God, is creating. Right. And creating a child, creating a song, creating something from nothing is a wonderful and beautiful thing. And that's what Dolly did. And then look what Whitney did. She breathed life into this song in a way that almost caused Dolly Parton to run her car off the road.
Not to take away from the story, but I saw an AP story not too long ago, 2 weeks ago, maybe, where some they did a study, or they did a little bit of a background documentary on USA for Africa, of which the song We Are the World came from. And I was very struck by that. So I turned over to Twitter and I looked at the producer and so forth. And it comes to mind because the part of the story they didn't cover was the money that was raised. And interestingly enough, I happened to be in the telecommunications business at the time, and we took those calls. And we took those calls for almost a month, but we were only supposed to take them for the weekend. But there were so many phone calls, Lee, worldwide, that AT&T called us and said, we have to get these calls off of our switches. I'm going to pass these calls on to you, and you're just going to have to let them be, you know, ring with no answer. And so the fascinating thing about We Are the World is that every radio station across the world that they were able to reach played the song to introduce it at the very same time. And that song sat out there for a couple of years. And so the point is that music, while you said we are a divided place, and we are, music can very often bring a lot of people together and, you know, new relationships and connective tissue is created, correct?
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that's why so many of us have great pains when recording artists or athletes get political. There are these spaces, and even our pastors, frankly. Mm-hmm. There are these places we go, our sacred places, where we get to be together or to contemplate things other than the worldly things. And to celebrate even our own differences and get together and let's mm-hmm. not talk about what we don't have in common. Let's talk about what we do. This game. There used to be many more civic places. And just because the world's a tougher place doesn't mean we can't do better. All of us can't do better on that front. With our neighbors who we might not agree with family members we may not agree with, there's still the question becomes, how do we move on with our lives despite those disagreements? And sometimes it's hard, and sometimes it's not possible. And sometimes you got to put everything on hold for a bit. But boy, it's a big world, and there's great joy out there. And I hope through politics and the nature of the toxicity in politics that it doesn't get all of us to just lose our joy of life. And to think, oh, and especially young people thinking the world's going to burn because of climate change. It's a hideous thing to teach kids. And I see so many kids thinking there's no hope. And, you know, this is like the late 1970s where everybody was, things were looking dire in the 70s. We had gas shortages. We had lines for oil, gasoline. You had to go every other day. You're worried that we were going to run out. Inflation was, it makes today look like kids walk. I mean, yes, my dad told me that the mortgage rates were 14% in the early 1980s. Can you imagine? I mean, nobody could buy a house.
And mine was 17% when I built the house.
Yeah, and that's crazy, right? And yet mm-hmm. we made it through that, right? And we did. And there was suffering. I'm not saying there's not suffering, but even amidst suffering, how do you find if you're sick and you're laying in a hospital? You can sit there and just whine and moan, or you can try and find a laugh somewhere. See some beauty even in that, even as we're suffering, how to find goodness and joy
lining.
Around us.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Or you might as well just like hang yourself, right? And that's not an option. It's just not an option.
Do you find, turning back to Dolly Parton and Whitney Houston, I think a lot of the unsung real heroes are the songwriters. It's always the singer that gets all the attention and so forth. But the real heartfelt emotion and message comes from the actual songwriter, and they're often forgotten. Do you agree with that?
Well, I you know, they're forgotten. Most of the folks out, particularly in country music, where a lot of the songwriters mm-hmm. Are not the singers. But, you know, the industry knows who's who, but the audience doesn't often.
Right.
Some singers go out of their way to mention the songwriters, some don't. But the fact of the matter is, if you're a songwriter and your song gets picked up by George Strait or whomever it gets picked
Bokey
up
Robinson,
by, or the
yeah,
young
right.
artist of today, you're thrilled. You're thrilled. And that's your job, is to write the song and then get paid handsomely for it because you're getting the royalties. Every time that song is spun,
yes.
And if it weren't for that singer, you'd have some notes on a piece of paper. I think most songwriters, I know my sister's a professional songwriter and had written a couple of hit songs and her husband produced some hit records. They were just so happy to be a part of a hit record. And the people who knew, the industry knew, and they liked it that way. They didn't want the fame that came along with, or the notoriety that came along with a lot of the stories. I sometimes think that the person who's the happiest is the songwriter who gets the royalties, doesn't have to deal with the fame.
Well, you know, another big songwriter was Burt Bacharach. I'm sure that my audience has no clue who Burt Bacharach was. But, you know, he did a little bit of singing, but he was mostly into the writing and you know they not only wrote songs but they also you know for common listeners, but the other piece is that they would do jingles and they would make a lot of money doing jingles for advertisers, and so I think that you know they probably could use a little bit more attention, which is the reason I'm so pleased that you're really talking about you know, Dolly Parton and how really it became, you know, much more of a popular song because of Whitney Houston versus, you know, Dolly Parton. And another one is Barry Manilow. He wrote some amazing music. And he sang too, but I think he had more volume in being a writer than he did in a singer. Would you agree?
Well, I think he did both. I mean, if he had not sung his songs, he did write hit songs, there's no doubt. But I think him singing and performing his mm-hmm. songs like Elton John did really set him apart. Burt Bacharach did sing a little bit, but my goodness, almost all of the songs. I mean, and think about the songs. I'll Never Fall in Love Again, What the World Needs Now, The Book of Love, A House Is Not a Home, Close to You, April Fools. I mean, Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. I mean, I could just go on and on. It's amazing what Burt Bacharach did. And yeah, he did ultimately sing, but you know, he's known not as Burt Bacharach, the singer. He's known right. through the other singers All who right. sang Burt Bacharach songs. He's an okay singer. He's an unbelievable songwriter.
Well, I think because of Dolly Parton and the decisions she made, she went on to be very quietly, I would argue, very successful, you know, not only with just singing, but, you know, in business. She became a shrewd business person, but is probably one of the kindest, most gracious and generous people you'd want to ever meet, correct?
Oh, I mean, all around the country and the world, Dolly's just a theme. And how she's managed to do it as she's done it. And by the way, to amass great wealth, but to be incredibly generous too. I mean, you know, the net worth of Dolly Parton is some estimates are at $500 to $600 million. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't carry herself that way. And her generosity is legion and well known. But she's also a movie star. I mean, you got to remember, she was in big hit movies. And she's now a Netflix star and won a Grammy. I mean, won an Emmy for her Netflix, The Code of Many Colors. Still relevant today. Heck, she did a song she did a remarkable duet with a great Christian contemporary songwriter and singer, Zach Williams. Not too long ago, There Was Jesus. She doesn't hide her faith either. Mm-hmm. And yet she's respectful of people who have no faith at all. And she's just a lovely model for how we could all be, despite everything that's going around. There's this little piece of joy and peace and sunshine in the mess. That's a beautiful thing. More of us should want to aspire to that. Why not?
Well, I'm, you know, very happy to have this discussion, because often we end up talking about politics or scandals or, you know, lack of law and order and all these kinds of things. So, you know, having the story of Dolly Parton, which I think is still probably not a finished story by a long stretch. I think that, you know, she's always climbing a mountain someplace and, you know, her story continues. But to come from less than nothing to be where she is today should be inspiring. In fact, you know, I would argue, you know, in probably in public school in some, you know, history class or civics class, somebody ought to, you know, really tell that story, because I think it's inspiring. So,
well, you know, I couldn't agree more.
Very happy to have this discussion and kind of start off the show with Dolly Parton, and I will always love you, Kevin Costner and Elvis Presley and Colonel Tom Parker and Porter Wagner. Absolutely fascinating. So, Lee, thanks for bringing this to us. I'm going to look for you for more happy songs and happy stories, and you know, certainly your podcast known as Our American Stories. So thank you for having this discussion and giving us a little joy and kickoff. So thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, there's more coming your way. Stay with us.
Mama, what does the chicken say?
Chicken. Oh, okay.
When the wolf?
Oh, a wolf.
What about the tiny dog? Cat. Owl. Dolphin? What does the turkey say? Whale.
Whale sound.
Do the giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Okay. Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're so pleased that you stayed with us here on the Denise Simon Experience. I've got the amazing pleasure of introducing you to Catherine Engelbrecht, somebody that I have watched for a very long time, somebody that I almost think if there's any kind of Patriot Award nationally recognized, she should get it in probably every month, because she's never not been in the fight. And I invite you to go over to truethevote.org, truethevote.org. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us. And most of all, thanks for the work that you do when it comes to voter integrity. It's a fight that I think changes just really almost every day with what the left is trying to do and successfully has done. When it comes to voter rolls and ballot boxes, I mean, every day for you is a different challenge, is it not?
It's true. And thanks so much for having me, Denise, and thank you for your kind words. It is true that this is an evolving battle, and we adapt and address the coming challenges as they present themselves, try to stay ahead of the curve. I think I see where they're headed for 2024. I called 2020 in the summer of 2020, all the way through to the election being settled in the House of Representatives, although I didn't foresee the setup of January 6th. But other than that, I could have told you, and then did on a video I put out back in that summer, that it was going to be a confluence under that fog of COVID, that there would be the use of the dirty voter rolls to catalyze the mass mail out of ballots and push those into unmonitored drop boxes, and it would end in chaos. And, now I think we're seeing, fortunately, a lot of states, or maybe not a lot, but some, in some key states, have removed those drop boxes, have pulled back on some of the mass mail out tendencies. So we've made some strides, but the issues surrounding this, the loss of any semblance of order at the border and the migrant, influence, I think is going to find its way into our elections. And so that's what we're preparing to most aggressively address right now.
Some of the states have worked pretty hard. DeSantis here in Florida, Kemp in Georgia, which, obviously, that caused a lot of craziness in Georgia, not so much in Florida. But, it's fascinating to me that some of these other states have not stepped up, especially when it comes to the Republican Governors Association. We know that these governors are having these discussions. And the fact that you've got 27, 28 Republican governors, I would think that there would be much more work done there. Would you?
Yes. But I tell you what. I mean, Denise, I've been doing this since 2009, and
yes.
I have. When politicians get things right and can hear that signal through the noise, we certainly celebrate. But my faith for the continuance of our republic is firmly placed on the shoulders of the American people. We have the power to do this. And so, you know, anything that we can help bring attention to as a group, to the attention of our representatives, then that sometimes can, you know, and does. I don't want to short sell it. I mean, it does have impact. But the problems with our elections are run so deep and have been so layered for so long that I think it many politicians just look at it and go, man, I just hope I can beat it by enough that I can kick the can a little further down the road. And, you know, and there's going to come a point where you can't do that anymore. And we're certainly close to it in terms of federal elections. You can't avoid the inevitable any longer. We are at that tipping point, but you know, it's, politicians tend to see things their own ways in their own minds, and that's why I think it's a little more difficult than it ought to be to get some proactive movement. But then again, you know, things are changing, so I'm hopeful.
Well, I appreciate your hope. I'm I hope, I think too, but I guess I would say that our biggest enemy is Mark Elias. Are you familiar with him?
Oh, sure. He's on the, we're on the receiving end of many of his lawsuits right now. In fact, he's going on a war path.
Yes.
There's been a recent sort of talking points memo that's apparently been issued to all of the, you know, the Legion of Doom that is all about, you know, calling out those groups that have helped to challenge ineligible voter records. And we're, of course, you know, the sort of the leading edge of that spear. And so he's hitting us pretty hard. And as I mentioned, we're involved in a couple lawsuits with him. But yeah, he is absolutely willing to say or do anything for his side, quotes, to win. And he'll play any side of the argument. If it serves him to say that the machines are a problem, he'll say the machines are a problem. If it serves him to say that to claim machines being a problem is a conspiracy theory, then he'll claim that. And he is showered with hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. They're in 55 lawsuits across the country right now, just his firm. And you know, yes, they are absolutely trying to change the way we vote via lawfare.
Well, and I would say people are so intimidated by these lawsuits and by him that they just kind of capitulate. They kind of, you know, they throw up their arm and say, we can't do this, or, you know, they don't have the experienced lawyers to fight back. I'm looking at a site called democracydocket.com, mm-hmm. of which I think is his.
And it's his site, correct?
Yes. And if you go down, if you scroll down just one little click, you know, he put up something even today. It's past time to bring Trump to justice. Now, it isn't all just about Trump, but, you know, because all things Trump is really all things Republicans and conservatives and even independents and some Democrats that are jumping the shark to come over to the Republican side. So I call this man, and I've called him this man, Mark Elias, the most dangerous man in Washington, D.C., I think for the last like 5 or 6 years. It's probably gone longer than that, correct?
Yes, Mark Elias cut his teeth. If you think back to the 2008 election of Al Franken, there was the out of Michigan. He was Al Franken's attorney when Al Franken and Norm Coleman battled it out. Their election went into a recall, and they recounted those, not recall, I'm so sorry, recount. And they recounted, I think, 5 or 6 times and kept finding a few more ballots here for Franken and a few more ballots there for Franken. And once Franken won or got the lead, then the governor said, okay, well, we're done with the recounts. And Al Franken went on to be, I believe, the 60th or 61st vote necessary in the Senate to get the Obamacare passed, which was the big push. And it was, you know, all part of a master plan. And that's that was his start. And then he went on from there to be Hillary Clinton's attorney and the attorney for the Democratic National Committee, and has had his hooks in deeply ever since. You know, my take on Elias is he is a man driven by money and power, and mm-hmm. has no real true north to him, because he'll say whatever needs to be said to achieve his end goals, which seem to be aligning his pockets and enjoying, you know, his extended 15 minutes of fame. But it won't last much longer. Up until 2020, True the Vote was really the only national group focused on election integrity, and it was oftentimes a very lonely place to be, because we kept saying, you know, that these process flaws, these cracks in the system are going to come back to haunt us, and we must deal with this. And it just wasn't, you know, it takes an awful lot to really get the attention of the country. But it happened, thankfully, in a very painful way, to be sure. But it happened in 2020. And all of a sudden, you had people rushing to the stage that didn't really understand how the process worked, but they knew in their spirits, and they were right, that something was very, very wrong. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, from that time forward, many of them have stuck around and have gone up what can be a very treacherous learning curve, and have learned, okay, well, these kinds of arguments aren't going to be useful in court, because statistical probability isn't going to carry the necessary weight to sway a judge or jury. We must come with hard evidence, and that is very difficult to do in the immediate aftermath of an election where everything is just chaos. So as a movement, we've grown and learned, and I think now we're beginning to put up better arguments and are far better equipped to go into 2024. So it's a whole new day. And, you know, Elias is the reason he's in 55 suits is that things are changing across the country faster than they can try to control. And we are not nearly done yet. He is no longer the sole keeper of the, you know, the intelligence around election process. Lots more people now are involved and are willing and able to push back. We're still, you know, as a movement, still young, but we're getting there.
Catherine needs some help with something, and this happened with the whole Georgia case, because I heard one of the lawyers that work for Raffensperger say something, and it's disturbed me ever since. So help me with it, and that is printing of the ballots, because there's not a single go-to printer. Each voting district uses their own printer. They work with a lawyer or two, and then they design the ballot and the language and so forth and so on. And sometimes that needs to change. They need to change the language on, you know, some kind of down ballot initiative, or, you know, somebody gets added or whatever. And then they have to go back to the printer when the printer has, in fact, already printed the ballots. So they reprint them. But the question is, what happened to that first set of ballots? And that's what makes me nervous, because you've got, you know, these election officials in, you know, some, you know, area that already took delivery of 300,000 or 400,000 ballots, whatever the number is, and they turn out to be wrong, or there needs to be a correction. So then they go back to the printer. And so you got this other set of the first set of ballots that got printed, and it's kind of like, what happened? I mean, I don't know. And this cat, I've long since forgotten his name. You know, he actually made a remark about it, and they're not. There's kind of like no chain of authority on those after they get printed. Does that make you nervous, or have you given that kind of consideration on printing and the reprinting?
Oh, absolutely, yes. And what you are pointing out is frankly, and maybe disturbingly, just one such example of, you know, when we should be following a process that should be spelled out in ironclad procedure that you cannot deviate from, that shouldn't be optional, that should we should have an absolute chain of command for destruction.
Custody, I should say.
Right. No, you're exactly right. And we should have a clear step-by-step, here's what happens in your example, here's what happens if you need to reprint the ballots. Here's mm-hmm. how you do that, and you destroy the ballots, and you have proof of that destruction of by whatever means, and you have, you know, sign-offs and witnesses and even videoed samplings of what you've done. I mean, all of this should be thought through, and the fact that it is not tells us a lot
yes.
about the intent behind the process. And printing of ballots, I mean, we've just, to add to the dismay, I mean, we've just learned in a recently filed court case, we, meaning the country, has just learned that one of the representatives from the Fulton County Board of Elections has resigned because he and is now on record as saying Fulton County in 2020 didn't do any signature verification at all.
Right.
It was all a lie. So we have seen so much of that all over the country. And what you find is that even when there are oftentimes the procedures and the policies are not well written enough that you can really, you know, have a hook to hang on. Like there's nothing you can really force. But in many instances, there are things that you could force. That the standards are there and they just aren't followed. And so that tells us a few things. Number one, we've got to do better at following a standard path that comports with law. In 2010, Barack Obama shifted the standards for elections, and although states, thankfully and hopefully forever, always control elections, he made the election infrastructure part of our critical infrastructure nationally.
Yes.
And put that control right under Department of Homeland Security. And what came with that, though, the thing that we can use to our benefit is that if you have a process that is designated critical infrastructure, then as a standard, it must comport with certain security measures and practical processes that are defined in federal standard. And there's FISMA and FIPS and HAVA, different standards that have to be part and parcel of the process. Using those standards as a backdrop, you can find your way to a quick fix for the broken process of, okay, how do we handle these ballots? And how do we handle when the machines break? And how do we make sure that the machines are properly certified? And how do we make sure that our e-poll books are properly certified? And all of those things can be answered, or many of them, I should say, can be answered through normalization around those standards. But what we have to do as voters and engaged citizens is demand accountability. You know, the word of the day in 2020 was just lawlessness. It was like the wild, wild west. Just
yes.
do what you want. And we can't have that. If we see a breakdown in process, and there's so many, there's like, you know, a million rabbit holes to chase down, we have to be ready to go, okay. So, to your question, what happens when those ballots are reprinted? And run that to ground, you know, file an open records request and ask to understand the process. Begin to teach yourself or to try to find the information. If it's not available, then follow up. And let's leave no stone unturned and unearth as much of this as we can, because there's True the Vote can only do so much. I mean, there should be 1,000 True the Votes to really,
yes.
you know, get to the bottom of this. But everybody should feel empowered, like this is our deal. Elections are meant to be run by the people. So let's flex those muscles and get answers to those questions and demand accountability. We have so much more power than we realize. But people are waking up, which is why I have hope. So, you know, I mean, it's coming around more slowly than maybe any of us would like, but it's coming around.
I got an email from a radio listener out in Colorado, you know, because we
you
know that Colorado was trying to take Trump off the ballot. And of course, we know that decision. But interestingly enough, the ballots had already been mailed and Trump was on there. And so were all the others, or several of the other candidates that had already dropped out. So that's very confusing to a Colorado voter that may not be keeping up with all this nonsense. Then a couple of days ago, I got my own ballot in the mail here in Florida. Vivek Ramaswamy's on it. DeSantis is on it. They're already off the out of the race too. So it's so confusing to a voter. Are you running? Are you not running? Or are you keeping these names on here so we don't have to write anybody in? And so this really says to us that, you know, getting the ballots right and printing them in a timely fashion is so key. And we, even in Florida, we, you know, I was so disgusted when I saw that ballot. I mean, I couldn't believe it.
I mean, what I would say to that is, you know, this is when we think about, frankly, how does the rest of the world vote? Well, most of the rest of the industrialized world votes on election day, and then they have very narrow reasons around which they may have extended period or, you know, something, an excuse-based mail ballots for people that can't make it or that are infirm or whatever, but very limited. When you move outside of that to states that have, you know, 30 and 40 and more than 40 days of early voting and this push towards mass mail, that's where we find ourselves in this predicament, and dysfunction breeds dysfunction. You know, if we waited until election day, then you would have the most accurate information available. But that's not where we are. And it puts the onus on the voters in a really unfair way, because you rightly pointed out. So, you know, to somebody that isn't, you know, following this every, you know, day of the week, and they get a ballot, and, you know, maybe they just have, they're just not aware, and that's reasonable. They shouldn't have to be a politico to be able to cast a ballot that is, you know, that means something. But instead of presenting a clear option, I agree with you. I think that what's happened to our process in so many ways is that we have allowed it to become just, you know, perpetually chaos, and that serves the benefit of the people that know how to exploit those weaknesses. So, you know, if you want to diminish President Trump's positioning, then just flood the ballot with so many, you know, he's going to pick up just for want of clarity. Other of those candidates are going to receive votes that by rights they shouldn't, because they're no longer in the race. So it's, and there's so many examples of that. You know, why are our voter rolls so messed up? In private industry, you can resolve identity, residency, and citizenship in real time every day. It's not a big deal. The data exists. So why are our rolls so wrong? Well, same reason that the ballots are messed up, because it serves the parties that know how to exploit those weaknesses. And where are we? I'm praying for the day, and I believe we are going to see it, when President Trump is in office, and now he sees for himself how broken the process is. He could not have possibly seen it in 2016. He couldn't have, and he certainly saw it in 2020, and has had 4 years to see it all unfold. And so it will become, I believe, a pillar of his presidency is to make sure that we are doing all we can to become a world-class example of a functional process with integrity. And all of these options, I mean, this is not hard. I mean, register voters, let them vote, count the votes. It's just a process. You know, but we got to get there.
On your website, truethevote.org, you've got a toolkit. Would you sell us your toolkit so we can get our listeners over there to, you know, get smarter by the work that you've done? Tell us what this toolkit's about.
Yes, let me sell you our toolkits, which are totally free and available to anybody that wants to look at them. But yeah, so if you go to truethevote.org, at the top, you'll see a button that says engage. Click on that, and you'll see all the different options and things that you can that you can plug into. Now, I'll tell you, one other space on our website checkout is one that the button that says contact. That'll give you a drop down. Please, please, I encourage everybody to sign up for our newsletter where we are constantly communicating new things that are coming out. So that's the way to stay engaged is by connecting with us so that any new announcement you're going to be the beneficiary of. But in those toolkits, what we've tried to do is create how-tos for basic engagement. And we're beginning to do live webinars starting next week. We're going to start with how to build a local election integrity team to make sure that you've got proper coverage in your local community. So we're excited about that. But there's one piece, if you'd permit me, that I'd love to point out to your listeners.
Please, please.
So click on engage. And then when the dropdown appears, you will see an option called scan, check, protect. I love this new program that we have because it takes 5 minutes and it's sort of a challenge that we are putting out to all of America, because what it is a way with just a few simple steps in less than 5 minutes, you can, number one, if you're not registered to vote, get registered. Number two, if you are registered, you can check your registration in the state where you're registered to make sure it's active, it's accurate, everything's good. And number three, and maybe the most eye-opening, is if you have ever moved to another state since becoming registered to vote, we encourage you, and we give you all the instructions and the ways to do this, go to every other state where you've ever previously lived and check to see if you are still registered to vote. Mm-hmm. If you are still registered, we give you the steps to have your name removed. Most people think that in, you know, the modern era that we live in, that when you move, your registration gets canceled, and it doesn't.
No.
Now, it's, you know, we've done this, we've got so many videos now because we've been going to rallies and encouraging people to check in real time, and we video them as they are looking, they click on the state where they used to live, put in their information, and then this is not, by the way, done through True the Vote, that we're tying you directly to the state, so there's no middleman here. It's just go and see what the state says. We tie you to their actual database. And people are blown away. I mean, they just check state after state and they're still registered. So those registrations, when you think about the fact that those records are still there and the mass mail out of ballots and the availability of that voter registration, all manner of foul play can be acted upon and you would never be the wiser. So what we're encouraging everybody to do is go check your registration, check previous registrations, clean up, you know, it's a little spring cleaning, clean up your own backyard, and then send that page to everybody you know and say, this takes 5 minutes, and encourage them to do that and then send it on. Just think about this. This is, I love this math. If you send it to 10 friends, this is just, you know, the chain reaction. If you send it to 10 friends, and it keeps going within seven cycles. That's it. And I know that's like, you know, so old school, but within seven cycles, we will reach 100 million voters. We can absolutely, it's mind boggling. We can come close to cleaning the voter rolls just
ourselves
through this exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And how empowering is that? It's also, you know, True the Vote has long been involved in, you know, heavy lifts of lawsuits. This is like the Mark Elias story, you know, where we're challenging hundreds of thousands of ineligible records. And that takes, you know, there's lawsuits and years to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But one at a time, that's something that everybody can handle. The individual can handle, the county that finds out about the
information. Well, you're force multiplying here. You know,
that's exactly right.
You're kind of building your own army.
Exactly right.
Listen, Catherine Engelbrecht, you know, I'm giving you the award. I have to give it to you almost every day, but truethevote.org, ladies and gentlemen, scan, check, and protect. Catherine, thanks so much for carving out some time. I know that you're as busy as you can be, if nothing else, just for teaching. And thank you for all of that. And I wish you such success in all of this and success for the rest of us that, you know, are trying to maintain some integrity. So well done. Ladies and gentlemen, more coming your way on the Denise Simon Experience. Stay with me.
the conversation starter. This is Talk 92.1 WDDQ 8L Valdosta.